talk of Cleveland is necessarily to comment on the divergent perceptions which are held about Cleveland by those of us who live here and by all the others who do not live here. Most Clevelanders find this city a relatively comfortable industrial center. And we can think of many other great industrial towns where we had rather not live. To the others, Cleveland seems to you, to borrow a word from the language of our adolescence, the pits. A long, dismal sprawl along a dying lake. Those who have studied attitudes about Cleveland know that most of the people who live out there wouldn't be seen dead here. And most of the people who live here really don't want to pick up and to live there. And so the question is, will the real Cleveland stand up? Now, there's no doubt that Cleveland has become a central staple of comic relief in the media of the land. What other town has had a river that caught fire? What other town has had a mayor's hair that caught fire? What other town has had a mayor's wife who refused an invitation to a formal White House dinner because it interfered with her bowling night? What other town hired a 20-year-old short order cook to be its port director? What other town has done its domestic mayor? What other town has a school board president who disports himself in such a way that everybody snickers the minute they hear mention of school board president? He seems more like one of his own adolescent exhibitionists. I'm afraid that, like it or not, Cleveland has become Chelm. Chelm is the great city of Eastern European folklore where the stork made a mistake. Instead of leaving the normal components of wise men and fools, the stork left only fools and Chelm. Chelm is the town where, when they paved the streets, they paved right over all of the manhole covers for all of the utilities. Is that Cleveland? Rabbi Chelm really must have had a hand in building our justice center. It's told that one day he went to visit the prison of the town. And as he talked to the inmates, he found that all but a very few protested their innocence. So when he left the prison, he summoned the town council, and he had a proposal. The town really should have two prisons, one for the innocent and one for the guilty. And the economics of Chelm sound remarkably like the economics of Cleveland. I'm told that there's a young 24-year-old economist in Chelm who has a solution to all the problems of urban finance. See, the world makes a mistake. In the world, the rich who have money can buy on credit, and the poor who have no money must pay coin. That's obviously a mistake. In Chelm, the rich who have money will pay with money, and the poor who have no money will buy on credit. Now, there's always in Chelm a visitor, usually a Litvak. And this Litvak heard this discourse on urban economics, and he said, but if a storekeeper sells to the poor on credit, he's going to become poor himself. And there's an obvious answer to that, which came right to the economist's lips. Well, if he becomes poor, the storekeeper can buy him credit. He robbed Peter to pay Paul. That kind of economic logic, Chelm logic, is really no different than the logic of our mayor, who insists that a municipal light plant, which is losing money, and which must buy most of its power from the private utility, will somehow act as a measuring rod in terms of cost to the private utility, because its rates will keep the private utility's rates in line. It's buying power from the private utility, paying its rates, but somehow doing that, it's able to act as a measuring rod for what we should be charged for electricity. Now, the antics of our local vaudeville team have unfortunately projected Cleveland into the limelight as the city you think about immediately when you talk about the problems which are affecting the great industrial centers of the Midwest. What's happening to Cleveland is no different than what's happening to Buffalo or Youngstown or Toledo or Detroit or Milwaukee, any of the great towns which were built up during the industrial age of the United States. But because writers and columnists need a peg, and because one of our local clowns is always providing them the peg, somehow when you talk nationally about this problem, you immediately think of Cleveland. And Cleveland has become the symbol across the nation of a town which was once
burgeoning, growing. Between 1880 and 1930, Cleveland was the fastest growing town in these United States. A town which was on the move, which had illusions about becoming the best location in the nation, and now has somehow become, in their minds, the worst location in the nation. I suppose that Arkansas always deserves a come down, but clearly very few of us would agree that this is the worst location in the nation. But equally, we're going to have to live with the fact that the city fathers elsewhere are a little better behaved. And therefore, a great deal of talk is going to be generated about Cleveland, which will exaggerate our failings and exaggerate our faults, and to a certain degree will distract us from the major challenges which are at hand. For I ask myself, if I could choose the mayor of Cleveland, and I could think of the best people in the world to staff all of the departments of the city of Cleveland, would that exchange, which would be all to the good, obviously, would that exchange really solve the major problems which face our city? And the answer is no. Because the problems which face Cleveland are economic and structural and political, and they can't be waved away, and they can't be dismissed simply by more competent administrators. Now, the unique bookkeeping or non-bookkeeping which has taken place in Cleveland. Imagine a major city of this age which, after a year, does not know really whether it's $60 million or $23 million or $52 million in debt. That kind of kindergarten bookkeeping is a unique Cleveland accomplishment. But the fact that most of these cities are in debt and growing further and further in debt all the time is a fact of life. It's a fact of aging plant. It's a fact of aging population. It's a fact of a tax base which cannot meet the stress of inflation, much less the stress of the interest which must be paid on what is being borrowed. It's a fact that industry, having used up the town, is now in many cases willing to abandon the town. It's a fact that the towns of the Midwest were up at a time when everybody was very jealous of their boundaries. And so Cleveland is not the county, but a gerrymandered area within the county, one of 62 governing units. And over the last 30 years or more, at least since the end of the Second World War, those who are able, productive, upwardly mobile have been leaving the city. And the city, the central city, has received the poor and the elderly and those caught within the racial traps of our society. So that those who are least able to pay must pay the largest cost for the human problems and the social welfare problems and the pure welfare problems of modern America. When you look at the school systems of the county and the city, you see the problem. Only one school system has been challenged on the basis of desegregation and found guilty and ordered to desegregate. Well, God knows many of the school systems in the county are lily white. And that school system is the school system of the core city, which has the smallest tax base per student in order to meet its ongoing costs.
This fall, we went through a 5-week-long school strike, not under segregation, not on the cost of the segregation, but simply because the faculty of our schools in the city needed a raise. No one denied the fact that they were underpaid, and simple decency required that they receive what they were asking for. But the school system lacked the tax base to provide the money for the raise. And when Columbus finally found in the budget money to bail out the city for a few months, and that particular crisis was over, and a levy was submitted to the electorate in order to pay the cost, the ongoing cost of the school, that levy was defeated. Understandably so, because what was being asked? That the poorest, those who are on fixed incomes, those who suffer most from racism and from the inflation, that they bear the cost of the prejudices and of the human tragedy which is involved in an urban city. And until those structural problems are solved, or at least confronted, our cities will continue to decay at the core, and that rot will spread and touch all of us to a certain degree, all of us who have fled, all of us who are advantaged, all of us who really do not understand what it is like to live in the city of Cleveland. That's part of the tragedy. When you listen to the new group which has been brought together, the group whose slogan is Cleveland, the New Generation, which has raised $4.5 million from industry to public relate our town. You hear talk of a renovation downtown, a Renaissance Center like in Detroit. You hear talk of the need to increase the ability of the town to attract bright young people and to keep bright young people, to attract industry and to keep industry. And all these, in terms of the region, are important problems. But when you listen to the people who live in the city of Cleveland, what are their problems? That it takes 4 hours or 6 hours for the police to respond to a call? That arson is being committed in their neighborhoods and the fire department and the police have no way of combating the arsonist? That they live in areas which are served minimally in terms of garbage collection, sewage, and so on? The streets are unsafe, the lighting is inadequate? That the care which is to be emergency care available to them is spotty and erratic? Many of you may have heard, as I heard on the radio just last week, a woman testifying before the school board. She has a child in a junior high school in the city. It is now Thanksgiving time. The child as yet has had no instruction in English. The child as yet has had no instruction in mathematics. There's been a room sitter in those courses, but in the French course that she's supposed to be taking, there hasn't even been an adult to sit in the room. That's where the problem is. And if you wonder why the mayor of Cleveland has made such an issue about tax abatement, why he has determined that the big corporations downtown, those who would build downtown, are not to be given tax inducements to do the building, is because the people whom he represents will only pay the cost of new services, the cost of police protection, the cost of garbage collection and so on of these buildings, and will get little of the advantage. In terms of the larger region where you and I live, it may make every kind of economic sense to encourage this kind of building. But in terms of a family in their 60s or 70s living in a deteriorating area of Cleveland whose house assessment rates are going up every 2 years, whose tax rates are increasing as inflation increases, whose food bills are increasing, whose bills for the basic utilities are growing out of sight, out of their sight, out of their ability to pay. The idea of their paying for the privileges granted to the National City Bank, or their paying for the privileges that granted to whoever will build the so-called Ohio complex, makes no sense. They're not going to work in that office building. They're not going to be the construction people on the job. The people who will build the building, who will work in the building, live in the region, not in the city. And they're being asked to, in a sense, brokerage their future
for the advantage of you and I, who have long since abandoned them and abandoned most of their problems. And until we find political ways to restructure the taxing system so that you and I bear the human costs equally with those who live in the city for poverty, for race, for inadequate education, for public safety, until we find ways so that this burden is shared equitably and not as it's shared now, inequitably, the problems of the city as city will not be met, and the interior core of the area in which we live will continue to deteriorate. Studies have shown that for every dollar of income which has been brought into the city by people moving into the city in the last 10 years, $4 of income has left the city. And what is true in Cleveland is true in Pittsburgh, it's true in Detroit, it's true throughout this area. The abandonment of the city for the suburb and the exurb is an old story. What's left behind are those most in need, and we're asking them to pay the highest cost. And so the first solution, if solution there be, to the problems of the city, it must be a structural one, county government. Some way of making us all one. Making us realize that if we want to rebuild the city, we've got to be of the city. Not of Shaker Heights, not of Pepper Pike, not of Gates Mills, but of Cleveland. And that's part of the perception which comes there with great difficulty to so many. When I read the slick brochures which are put out by this new Cleveland, the New Generation Committee, I'm struck by the fact that nothing is said about these problems. The main story here reads, Saudi King rules from Cleveland. Now, King Khalid's entourage, I'm sure, brought in a great deal of money to Cleveland. And certainly the medical complex, which is the clinic and our hospitals, is one of the great producers of wealth for our city. But certainly it's equally true that the neighbors of the clinic believe that the clinic exists for the King Khalid's and not for their own. There's no emergency room at the clinic. And this sense that the other Cleveland, the wealthy Cleveland, the capable Cleveland, doesn't care about them, turns its back on them, is precisely part of the problem. It's a problem even to the populace, like Dennis Kucinich, who are elected because they voice some of the concerns of the neighborhoods. The minute they move away from those concerns, the neighborhood communities, as you've seen in the last several weeks, turn on them angrily. If I were head of the Cleveland, the New Generation Committee, I'd take some of the $4.5 million which I'd raised, and I'd give it to these neighborhood centers, which are increasingly organized, increasingly militant, and I'd find ways to help them solve the basic problems of the city of Cleveland: police protection, fire protection, neighborhood renewal, adequate education, the things we take for granted. Paradox of Cleveland. There are 62 governing units in Cuyahoga County. 61 of them are solvent. The only one that isn't is the city of Cleveland. There are 24 school districts in Cuyahoga County. 23 of them have been operating since the first week in September. 23 of them are well organized and adequately financed. Only one fails to be so, that of the city of Cleveland. And against that background, the Cleveland, the New Generation Committee puts out this glossy sheet, this came just last week, whose centerfold is a magnificent picture of a high-arched room in the new Inn on the Square, with great glass chandeliers and four or five well-dressed men sitting around a table in the back, obviously making money, not playing poker. Cleveland's never going to go into the Inn on the Square. It's too expensive for them. Cleveland doesn't go to the convention center. They're not in the trades. The poor people of Cleveland, the black people of Cleveland, live on the streets, live in neighborhood taverns and neighborhood areas. This isn't their Cleveland. And the renewal of downtown Cleveland, however desirable it may be to you and to me, is not the focus of their concerns. And committees which, with all the good intentions of the world, are as class-oriented as this committee obviously is, will never solve the problems of the other Cleveland. Cleveland that gives us all our name. Now, it's the other Cleveland, which is in the long decline. It's the other Cleveland that the newspapers write about. It's the statistics from the other Cleveland which makes such frightening reading. Mass exodus, influx simply of the poor, the halt, the lame, the blind, the aged, school systems which may not be able to operate beyond the turn of the year, a racial divide. That's the other Cleveland. But there's the Cleveland by whose name we are called, and it's the community which is the center of the area of which we're a part. Now, however well-intentioned groups such as this may be, until they get beyond their class and caste bias and begin to grapple not only with the economic problems of the region, but with the human problems of the city, so long will Cleveland continue in its long decline. And I, for one, believe that if you do not staunch that decline, if you don't breathe health into the center city, all that you do in the region will ultimately fail. Because it is Cleveland which will make the headlines. And it's the problems of Cleveland which create the violence and the crime and the unrest and all the rest, which make people flee an area such as ours. Now, what about the problem of perception between us and those who are like us elsewhere? Those of us who live in the more beautiful Cleveland, in the 61 suburbs and arid townships which are solvent, who can count on police protecting our home and fire people being there when we call them, and the emergency vehicle being available when we need it, whose schools are open, whose parks are policed, who can't understand why the rest of the country sees Cleveland as we do not. There is a perception problem. And there is a reason to bring into being groups which will concern themselves with trying to make others understand exactly what is available here. But first of all, we've got to clear up our own minds. There is the problem of the other Cleveland to which I've referred. There is the problem of our citizenship in that Cleveland. And there is also, I think, a necessary fact that all of us must reorient ourselves to accept the fact that we're never going to live in one of the great megalopolitan centers of the world, of the country. And that perhaps that's not so bad. Cleveland was once an arrogant town. It believed itself to have a great future. It would be one of the 3, 4, 5 top cities in the United States. But that wasn't to be. We're a second-tier city. We're going to remain so, whether we create a regional form of government or a county form of government, or remain as we are now governed. We're never going to be one of the major centers of power or of culture. But sociologists increasingly remind us that cities no longer have walls, that there's community without propinquity. I read during each morning a paper that's printed in New York City. The news I see on the television is from the national media. The books that I read are printed elsewhere. The professional groups of which I am part meet regularly in convention in other cities. We're part of a mobile society. Our families are scattered. Our children go away to school. Cleveland is no longer, whatever city we live in, is no longer the be-all and the end-all of our existence. We don't need everything in Cleveland. And what we have in Cleveland is in many ways very good. We have an easy transportation system. We're not very badly spread out. Few of us have to spend hours commuting. We have good schools. We have good music. We have good medicine. We have very agreeable suburbs. We have a standard of living which is not among the worst and most horrendous in the nation. There are many things outside the weather which are quite fine of the city in which we're a part. And if you look at county government rather than the government of the city, it's good, solid government. If you look at the security of our streets, they are safe as they can be in a modern urban center. There are many things of which we are proud, which we almost take for granted. And there is good reason, to try and make others understand what Cleveland is really like. But it will not be done if it's done simply on the basis of slick newsprint and a class-oriented committee. If I were to organize the public relations of our town, I would suggest it have not one motto, the Cleveland, the new generation, which sounds as though You know, discotheques and a little bit of the youth culture will solve all of our problems. Cleveland's never going to become the swinging capital of the United States. We're a family town. I would take two phrases. One, I would plagiarize from the United Jewish Appeal campaign of last year, "We are one." We are one. Not 62 towns, but one. We are one, and we are determined to find ways in which the strengths of the community will be given from all to all, and the taxing which is available here will be for the good of all. We are one, and the problems of the poor people in the center are our problems, and we refuse to turn our backs on them. And the other slogan that I would use is not Cleveland, the new generation, but towards a greater Cleveland, emphasizing that Cleveland is more than Cleveland. The Cleveland are the places in which we live and the institutions of which we partake. Some of them are in the city, the Playhouse Square and the University Circle area. Many of them are in the suburbs and the exurbs, or in the region for that matter. We have cars and we are mobile. Cleveland is more than Cleveland. Cleveland is not only all that's available here, but all that comes here, and all that we can partake of when we go elsewhere. And if we can keep these two perceptions in mind, perhaps we will be less diffident about our town, perhaps we'll have less of a cross to bear when others speak to us of the town. But I think that it is also more than a slogan, it must be a commitment. It must be a promise that you and I make to ourselves, that while all the great people from the Growth Association and elsewhere try to bring new industry into Cleveland, that we're going to remind ourselves that a town of 2.25 million people is larger than London or Paris or Rome or Amsterdam were in their heydays in the 19th and 18th centuries. That a great city doesn't have to have 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 million people. What it needs is to have some very solid, committed citizens, people who will stay. One of the things that worries me most about Cleveland is that so much of the leadership of the town still has that old American failing of believing in use up and get out. When the trappers first moved off of the New England coast, they used up the beaver and they used up the animal, and then they moved on to the Midwest and to the far west, using up their natural resource very quickly as they went. And when the cotton farmers planted in the south, they used up the land. They moved to the sugar plantations of Louisiana and the Mississippi Delta, and they used up that land. And then they began planting wheat on the Great Plains, and they used up that land and created the Dust Bowl. And when the first industrialists came to Cleveland, they came here because it was a convenient place to bring in the Mesabi ore and the Indiana limestone and the West Virginia coal and the immigrants from Europe. And they built plant, and they used up the plant, and they did very little to refurbish their plant. I'm told that in the last 3 decades, the major industries of Cleveland have invested less in research and development than the major industries of any other center in the United States. And so when the industrial age, the great iron and steel age, the age of brawn, which gave us our strength, was over, we were still being managed by men who were trained to another world, who were willing to invest the capital of the corporation in research, laboratories, development. And when the computer age, the technological age, the space age developed, our plants were not producing the equipment and the knowledge and the inventions that were essential to that world. And that world passed us by. It passed the whole area by. And now the corporate leaders of a new generation, many of them are wondering, should I stay? I have an old plant. Labor is paid a decent wage here. If I go to a new virgin area in the Sun Belt, I'll get tax abatement. I'll get rubes just in off the farm who aren't yet unionized. I don't have to pay at the same rate. I'll be able to have a new plant, a more efficient plant. Why should I invest in my city? Well, the answer is precisely because it is your city. Because you have taken advantage of it over the last 40 and 50 years. The city has had to build the schools. The city has had to provide the protection. The city has had to provide the laboring force and all the services which our ancillary to people. And when great drafts of people were brought up from the south and from the hills during the war, it is the city, ultimately, whose services were taxed. And when after the war, many of these workers were thrown out of work, it is the city welfare rolls that swelled because industry was not willing to keep workers on. Cleveland has been used, and by some who have already decamped, thrown away. And it matters not to me whether the head of an industry has been, you know, a good member of this or that board. The ultimate decision is a decision which involves the corporation because it involves the economic life of the community, this community. And those who have picked up and left are bad citizens because they have taken and not returned. Citizenship on all of our parts of a high order is obviously called for at a time such as this. Some corporations will continue to leave. Others, I'm sure, will stay. And if all of the forces of Cleveland are determined to make something of our future and begin to look at the strengths of Cleveland, they will discover that they are many. Still an easy town to get to and from. It's a wonderful town in which to raise a family. It's a town with unusual institutions, educational, religious, art, music. It's a very comfortable town in which to live, in many ways. It's a town which has solved all of the structural problems save the basic one. The one which we refuse to turn attention to because it's going to cost us time and effort and most of all money. That is, the problem of taking upon ourselves the burden of the other Cleveland. The Cleveland we don't even want to drive through. Cleveland that looks as if it were a bombed-out city during the Second World War. The contrast is overwhelming. But how many of you refuse to look at it? And how many of you really believe that you have a responsibility towards changing all that around? As I talk about Cleveland and begin to think about it, I'm reminded of another story about Chelm. In Chelm, a certain family had a milk goat. And one day this milk goat gave out. There was no more milk. And the husband wrung hands like this. He didn't know what to do, but the wife was a fairly practical person. She said, "Sell the goat. Who's going to buy a goat that doesn't give milk?" Well, she said, "There's our Litvak, our local Litvak. He's a smooth talker. Go to him, take the goat to him, go with him to the marketplace, and he'll sell the goat for you." So the homeowner took the milk goat to the Litvak, and the Litvak agreed. The two of them went to the marketplace, and the Litvak began his spiel. "I have a wonderful goat here. Look at this, the lines and the strength of the goat and the udders, how full this could be." And a customer came up and said, "Is this a good milk goat? Is this a good milk goat? This goat is like a wet nurse. It gives pails and pails of milk day in and day out. You couldn't have a better milk goat. This goat," and he went on in rhapsodic terms. And so overwhelmed was the original owner of the goat, he said, "Stop, I want it for myself." I like Cleveland. I want it for myself. Amen.